begin with the invocation.
Toward the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit guidance. Greetings and welcome to all who are gathered here today. And greetings also to those who are listening in from afar. I'd like to express my apologies for the inconvenience in the postponement of this class and say that with your good thoughts and prayers, I'm feeling much better now, with the exception of the occasional sniffle or sneeze, which you might hear today. The subject, as has been announced, is planetary prophetology, continuation of a theme that has been already explored in the two prior classes. But in conceiving of the vision of a planetary prophetology, a concern very quickly arises. And that concern is a very legitimate concern. And that concern is this: that we can observe that the subordination of women, misogyny, the dominance of patriarchy, is a global phenomenon and is present within every major world religion today. And so, if our project is to conceive of a planetary prophetology, a prophetological vision that acknowledges the validity of all of the world's faiths, and attempts to articulate a single global flow of wisdom that includes them all, is there not a danger that this planetary vision will become an aggregate of patriarchies, a super patriarchy, so to speak, concatenation of the patriarchal tendencies inherent in all religions, conceived on a global scale? It is a very off-putting idea. So we need to explore further the nature of the misogynistic bias inherent in the world faiths, and whether it is essential or accidental. If it is essential, then it derives directly from the mystic inspiration of the prophets. And if it is accidental, it is an overlay, so to speak, an overlay that buries under its weight the pure egalitarian message that is the ultimate truth of revelation. And if so, we must strip away the veils of accretions, cultural accretions, to reveal that egalitarian essence and seek out the exegeses, the mystical techniques of interpretation that reveal the occluded feminine dimension of revelation. So that is an enormous undertaking, but also an extremely urgent one, living in an era in which we are witness to the atrocities of war, gargantuan pollution, ferocious fundamentalism, all symptoms of an inherent imbalance. And the reaffirmation of the feminine is essential to redressing that imbalance. Now, having introduced this subject, I must begin with an admission, which is that I do not feel well placed at all to speak on this subject. On the contrary, it is presumptuous for a man such as myself to speak for and about women's experience of the sacred. And ultimately, what is most necessary is to bring forth women's own voices to define their own visions of the sacred. But having said that, I must also acknowledge that as a public figure representing a spiritual tradition, I would be remiss to ignore or sideline this important issue. And so I do venture forth into this conversation, but in a spirit of humility and respect, and recognizing that if I have some measure of authority to speak, it is by virtue of my own living relationships with women who have been an inspiration to me in my life, and also the recognition that every human being contains within both the masculine and feminine dimensions. Now, the vision of planetary prophetology that has been explored in these classes is inspired by the vision of Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan, my grandfather. And I want to begin by quoting his words from an autobiographical essay that he wrote titled East and West. He wrote this in the 1920s. There is no line of work or study which woman in the West does not undertake and does not accomplish as well as man. Even in social and political activities, in religion, in spiritual ideas, she excels man. I can see as clearly as daylight that the hour is coming when woman will lead humanity to a higher evolution. These are words that have oracular power. And Murshid was speaking in a time when, in the country in which he lived, France, women had yet to obtain the right to vote or stand for office, which came only in 1944. And yet in his own organization, Murshid delegated the highest authority to women, and the senior-most leaders within the Sufi movement were four women: Rabia Martin, Sharifa Goodenough, Sophia Green, and Fazlmay Eglin. Later, at the end of his life, Murshid returned to India and explained his thinking on this subject to Khwaja Hassan Nizami, who oversaw the Dargah of Hazrat Nizamuddin Aulia in Delhi, and who was among the very foremost Sufi authorities in that time. And later, Murshida Rabia Martin visited Khwaja Hassan Nizami. And having met Hazrat Pir Murshid Inayat Khan and Murshida Rabia Martin, Khwaja Hassan Nizami's thoughts on the subject of women's roles in Sufism were affected. And he explains this in his Roznamcha. He says, although we don't find reports in the biographies of the great ones of the past of them granting khilafat or succession to women, still, on investigating the principles and rules of Sufism, there does not appear to be any harm in granting females khilafat. Therefore, I gave permission to teach my silsila to the daughter of Hakim Altaf Hussein, Rashida Nisa Begum, and bestowed on her the name Malakut Begum. Especially in Europe and America, it is the women who can contribute to laying the groundwork and bringing to conclusion the work of spreading the message. Today, it is due to the efforts of these very women that Sufi Inayat Khan's thousands of disciples are increasing in Europe and America, in whom feelings of spiritual purity, moral goodness, worship of God, love, and empathy are to be found to a much greater extent than in others. So in this paragraph, we have a glimpse into the process whereby a tradition updates itself, updates its practices and protocols based on the clear evidence of the rightness of a new practice, in this case, the rightness of the inclusion of women. Which isn't to say that there haven't historically been exceptions and precedents in Sufi history. Of course, the very greatest Sufi of the earliest phase was Hazrat Rabia al-Adawiya of Basra, who lived in the 8th century. She was an ecstatic, antinomian mystic. She is said to have gone about in less than modest dress, and seemed to care little at all what people thought of her apparent immodesty. Until once she was seen to suddenly, after walking brazenly through the marketplace, retreat and hide. And she was asked, what is the reason for this change in behavior? And she answered, women must by law cover themselves in the presence of a man. And just now, on the street, I saw the saint Hassan al-Basri. And until this moment, I had never seen a man. Another great woman figure in the history of Sufism is the daughter of Khwaja Garib Nawaz, of Khwaja Moinuddin Chishti, his daughter Bibi Hafiza Jamal. And it is said that she was granted full authority for the passing of the transmission. She was made a Khalifa. Another great woman saint of India was Bibi Fatima Sam, who was the sole sister of Hazrat Nizamuddin Awliya. And people used to inquire whether it was really possible that she could be a saint if she was a woman. And Hazrat Nizamuddin answered that if a tiger jumps out from bushes, do you ask if it's a male tiger or a female tiger? And then there was a great saintly lady who played a very important role in the life of Hazrat Nayat Khan. When he went to Hyderabad, he had a certain objective, a desire at that time, and that desire was as yet unfulfilled. And his friend brought him to the presence of an old lady who sat under a tree. She was a Qalandar, a wandering dervish. And they approached her respectfully. And she took some food that she had been chewing in her mouth and took it out into her hand and offered it to Hazrat Inayat Khan. And he was a very prim and proper young man, and at first was very startled by this dilemma. He was being asked to take into himself this chewed food. And yet, in a spirit of trust, he did so. And he says that the very next day, that desire that he had long nurtured, it was fulfilled. Also, the mother of Hazrat Pir Murshid, Khadija Bi, played a very important role in his life. And we know that while she was pregnant with Murshid, she had visions of the prophets. The prophets came to her in her dreams with messages. Now, the reason that Murshid's oracular utterance that women shall lead humanity to a higher evolution is so striking is that it stands in sharp contrast against the long history of subordination, misogyny, repression that is all too familiar. We are all familiar, I think, with this heritage. And too much need not be said to prove its reality. The evidence is everywhere apparent throughout history. A striking example is the word hysteria, which describes a state of dementia, of emotional overexcitement. And that word is taken from the word hystera, the Greek word for the womb. So the condition of the woman, the possessor of a womb, is assumed to be incomparably inferior at the level of mind. And the consequence of this conception, of course, has had very real ramifications in women's life throughout history. However, it seems that it was not always so. Archaeological evidence reveals feminine figures, ceramic figures, that are the primary artifacts of the Paleolithic and Neolithic eras. So whatever evidence we do have about religion in prehistoric periods, it points to a religiosity that revolved around a deep acknowledgement of women's fertility and power. The matron figure was the primary symbol. This is evidenced in artifacts that can be traced far back into the, as far as the Paleolithic period, but which are abundantly to be found in the Neolithic period at sites such as Çatalhöyük in Turkey. And these relics, these artifacts, suggest a very different culture, a culture in which women's place was primary, in which fertility was celebrated. The settlements reveal minimal or no fortifications, and there is no evidence of organized warfare in these periods, as well as no evidence of centralized structures of authority. So all of the evidence suggests a time of peace, social equilibrium, and the predominance of the sacredness of the feminine. But somehow, somewhere, these patterns, these life rhythms were altered. And there are various theories about how and why that happened. According to Maria Imbutas, it was an invasion of nomadic pastoralists from Russia that swept down over Central and Southern Europe and dominated those matriarchal societies and repressed their religion and introduced instead the veneration of the sky god and martial tendencies. And this may historically correspond to a real situation. However, that explanation, of course, is Eurocentric. It does not explain the prevalence of patriarchy in other regions of the world, nor does it really explain the cultural progression that led to the domination of the male principle. Because after all, how did those Kurgans, the Kurgan nomads, how did they become patriarchal in the first place? We need to seek a fuller answer. The theory of the invasion might be part of the puzzle. And when we look to fuller analyses, of course, there are multiple theories. There is the theory that as agriculture developed, agriculture beginning with horticulture being naturally a feminine undertaking, the men serving primarily as hunters. But as agriculture developed technologically, it became big business, so to speak, and issues of a surplus arose, and surplus was equated with power, and questions of possession and property arose, and competition for property and possession. And within this, women increasingly fell under the category of possessions. Another theory holds that the rise of patriarchy can be linked with the alphabet, with writing. This is an extremely interesting theory advocated by a neurosurgeon, Leonard Schlein, who reminds us that the brain is bicameral. The brain's functioning operates through two distinct but interrelated hemispheres, the right and the left. The right hemisphere associated with the functioning of the left side of the body, and the left hemisphere with the right side of the body. And there is, in the case of the human species, as opposed to every other species, there is extreme differentiation in the functioning of these two hemispheres of the brain. And the left hemisphere, which controls the right hand, is associated with, in language, grammar. And the right hemisphere is associated with cadence. So the left hemisphere is concerned with logical sequences, rational arguments, and the right hemisphere is associated with holistic judgments, intuitions, perceptions of musicality. These are two different modes of cognition. And of course, both men and women utilize both hemispheres of the brain. But historically, men have been socially conditioned to specialize in the activities associated with the left brain, and women more with right brain related activities. And it's also true that women have a greater number of connecting neurons in the corpus callosum, which determines the interplay between the two hemispheres. So women are biologically wired, so to speak, for greater integration. Now, verbal language includes visual signs, it includes the musicality, the cadence of the voice, whereas written language is reduced to terms that become increasingly abstracted from an embodied experience. And so the invention of the alphabet first in cuneiform, in Sumer, and subsequently the development of alphabets leading to Phoenician, which is then the root of Hebrew, as well as Greek, as well as the Brahmi script used in India, represents an enormous innovation that had deep implications for global civilization. And one can see that this development coincides with the diminution of the importance of the goddess figure and the rise in the pantheons of those cultures, in the Babylonian pantheon and later in the Greek and Roman pantheons, the rise of the male figures and culminating in the hegemony of a figure in the Greek pantheon, the figure of Zeus, and in the Roman of Jupiter. And the formulation of the laws of Hammurabi coincide historically with the advent of the myth of the overthrow of the feminine Tiamat by the male divinity Marduk, who literally slays Tiamat and from her body creates the world. That myth of the slaying of the feminine divinity, who is now portrayed as the principle of chaos, as opposed to the order represented by the god Marduk. The advent of this myth corresponds to the enactment of the laws of Hammurabi, which is, of course, the further continuation of the logic of a civilization more and more determined by literary culture and its consequences. Now, it's also interesting to note the distinction between Hebrew and Arabic on the one hand, and Greek on the other hand. Hebrew and Arabic are on the Abjad system, which means that the alphabets are exclusively composed of consonants, whereas the Greek alphabet contains the introduction of vowels. That is an innovation. The innovation of the vowels into the alphabet in Greek represents, we might say, a continuation of this linear development of abstraction. Now, if in the Abjad system, where the vowel is not present, to read a text means to breathe the vowelization into the words. The words are not self-sufficient on the page or on the tablet. The words have to be animated by the breath of the body in the act of reading. Whereas in the Greek alphabet, the alphabet becomes more self-sufficient, closed, distinct from human biological processes. Now, a further development along these same lines is much later, the introduction of movable type, the Gutenberg press, which standardizes texts, enabling absolute precision in the transmission of texts, which is the precondition for the flourishing of the exact sciences, as occurred subsequently in the Enlightenment and in the period of the Industrial Revolution. A certain civilizational trajectory was enabled by the furtherance of a literary culture that has become extremely technologically refined. Now, it's interesting that as soon as the vowels were introduced in the Greek alphabet, already Plato could begin to speak about what are called Platonic ideas, abstract ideas that exist in a void, so to speak, disembodied. That is, we might say, a natural consequence of the implications of this, the closed system of the Greek alphabet. A further implication is the textual transmission of printed texts that create the proper environment for the full elaboration of the modern rationalist, materialist, scientific worldview and its great advances in technology. But what is progressively lost in this arc is the living, breathing, organic relationship with meaning. Meaning becomes reduced to pure information, abstracted, existing in a plane of its own, beyond the earth. And you might say that the internet, in some way, is the apotheosis of this very progression. Interestingly, Philo, the Hellenistic Jewish philosopher, identifies Sophia, the feminine wisdom, with the vowels. He says that the Sophia principle is in the vowels. So we can see that the relationship between masculine and feminine is not unrelated to this question of development of autonomous texts. disembodied. Now, while the post-Neolithic period, the period of early recorded history, the historical period, what is sometimes called the Axial Age, is certainly a period in which the divine feminine experienced a demotion and the masculine principle was elevated. At the same time, we can look and find examples of the abiding relevance of the feminine in the theologies of this period, particularly in the experience of the mystics, who were never content to allow the feminine dimension of the sacred to be forgotten. So, for example, in the book of Proverbs, we find the voice of wisdom, Chokmah. Chokmah speaks as a celestial person. In Proverbs 8:22, she speaks and says, "The Lord created me, the beginning of his works, before all else that he made long ago." So there is in the Bible this very clear indication of the precedence of the sacred in the order of the sacred feminine in the order of creation. Now, in the monotheistic revelations, the revelations of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, the feminine element of the divine continues to find a place, albeit sometimes within the subtext, one has to look deeply, but it is there. And the feminine is frequently associated with the principle of creativity, the act of creation. And God is the creator, and so God must evince this feminine dimension. And women, embodied women, are the symbol of this. So Hazrat Maulana Rumi writes in his Masnaviya Ma'navi, "Paratoi hakast an ma'shuq nist, khaliqast an guya makhluq nist." She is no mere object of affection. She is a ray of the truth. She is a creator, you might say. She is not created. Rumi is speaking here of women. She's not merely the object of your desire. She's a ray of God. She's not merely a created creature. She is creative. She is the living symbol of the divine creativity, the purest evidence of that creativity. And Ibn al-Arabi writes of the Nafas ar-Rahman, which is the breath of the all-compassionate. He understands creativity as a vast cosmic breath that releases the divine qualities from the confinement of the condition of God as a hidden treasure. This great breath carries the attributes into being, into life, into experience. A great sigh of creative compassion. And the name that he gives to this sigh, the Nafas ar-Rahman. And the word Rahman refers to the two foremost attributes of God repeatedly invoked in the Quran. Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim, the merciful and the compassionate. And these two words both come from the root rahama. And that root describes the womb. The word for the womb is from the same root. So the most essential qualities of the divine creativity and love come from an affirmation of the womb. So that word, the breath of the all-compassionate, contains two words, Rahman, evoking the womb, and the other is nafas, which means a breath. But that word is also related to the word nafs, which means soul or self. And that word is grammatically in Arabic feminine. So sometimes that has been used against women. The argument has been made, women are of the nature of nafs, interpreting nafs as the lower self, the ego. However, nafs can also be nafs al-mutmaina, the tranquil, illuminated, the awake self. And the association of the feminine with the nafs or the self indicates a recognition that women have a special experience of personhood, of what it means to care for children, to care for the world, to experience and affirm the embodied state, not merely to seek consolation in abstraction and transcendence, but the true affirmation of embodied, ensouled life on earth. That is indicated by the word nafs, and that is the correlate to nafas. Now we can also look at the name Allah, because as perhaps I've mentioned in a previous class, according to Sheikh Najmuddin Kubra, the word Allah is derived from the definite article Al, which is doubled. The L is doubled, becoming intensified thereby. So the definite article means the, and if it is intensified, it means the very, the one and only. So we have accounted for the A-L-L, and what remains? Ha. Ha. So for Najmuddin Kubra, God's name, Allah, means the ha, the breath. But what else is ha? Ha is the sound of the breath. It also is the feminine pronoun. That is how you make a feminine noun, by the addition to the noun of the suffix ha. So ha is the feminine pronoun, the feminine name. So it's right there implicit in the divine name Allah. And it is elaborated in the full form of the feminine pronoun hiya, hiya, which is the counterpart of huwa. And Gisu Daraz, a great Chishti saint, wrote in his Wujud al-Ashiqeen, the ocean absorbs all impurities. It has no bottom depth and no shore, so that one can say of it only, hiya, hiya, she is she. And if anyone demands, how dare I use a feminine pronoun for God? I'll answer that in the night ascension, the divine epiphanies of glory, the divine epiphanies of the glorious and high that appeared to our prince, peace and blessings, were also of feminine form. And speaking too of this feminine pronoun, the letter ha, Ibn Arabi says is in his commentary on the Tarjuman al-Ashwaq, his inspired poems. He says, my intention with this poem is to portray only her, that is the letter Ha, the feminine pronoun. I have no other attachments beside the one to her. For my attachment to the world of phenomena exists entirely for her sake, because she reveals herself in it. So we have talked a little bit about the mystic's recognition of the feminine dimension of God. And now we should consider, what is the feminine role in prophecy, in the revelation of the divine word? And here we immediately encounter the concept of the Shekinah, which is so prevalent in the mystical theory of Kabbalah, which is found in the Zohar, and which Gershom Scholem, the great Kabbalist scholar, tells us is the equivalent of Goethe's eternal feminine. In the Talmud, Shekinah represents the tangible presence of God, not God in the abstract, but God tangibly, palpably present on earth. So God's presence on Mount Sinai, God's presence in the temple, and particularly God's presence as dwelling, resting upon the prophets. This Shekinah, this feminine divine presence, is that which rests upon the prophets. And it is also in this context known as the Ruach HaKodesh, or in Arabic, the Ruach al-Quds, the Holy Spirit through which the prophets speak. So the prophetic speech is animated by this feminine emanation of the presence of God. Now this Ruach HaKodesh or Ruach al-Quds makes its appearance in Surat al-Qadr, in the Quran Sharif, where the night of power is described. And remember, night is the phase of day that is presided over by the moon. And in those very ancient effigies of the feminine divinity, she was shown holding the crescent moon. There is an innate correspondence between women, the myths of women's fertility and the cycles of the moon. And of course, there is an innate biological correspondence between the moon and women's cycles. And the moon in its, the sun is perpetual in its light, but the moon waxes and wanes. And so the moon symbolizes the cycle of life and death. And this is a cycle that historically, mythologically, has been deeply associated with women's experience of the sacred. And so this surah is a surah about the night. And remember, who in the civilization of Islam personifies the night? It is Layla. Layla, who is the beloved of Majnun, the archetypal beloved. So night, the feminine, it carries many resonances. But in the course of this surah, night is shown to be the special time when something descends from the angelic planes and comes down into earth, into manifestation. And that which descends on this night of power is the hosts of the angels and the Ruach al-Quds, the Holy Spirit. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إنا أنزلناه في ليلة القدر وما أدراك ما ليلة القدر ليلة القدر خير من ألف شهر تنزل الملائكة وروح فيها بإذن ربهم من كل أمر سلام هي حتى مطلع الفجر صدق الله العلي العظيم. Truly we caused it to descend on the night of power. And what will explain the night of power? The night of power is better than 1,000 months. In it we caused to descend the angels and the Ruh al-Quds, the Holy Spirit, on every task. Salamun hiya hatta matla al-fajr. She is peace. That night is peace until the break of dawn. Now this spirit that descends on the prophets is called in the Quran the Sakina, which is the Arabic form of the word Shakina, the Sakina. It is said in Surah Toba, God sent his Sakina on the prophets and on the faithful. And it is said in Surah Baqarah, the phrase is mentioned, At-tabut fihi Sakina, which can be translated as an ark filled with the Sakina, because the Ark of the Covenant held that feminine emanation that is the Sakina. But it is also interpreted by commentators to mean a heart full of tranquility, because Sakina also means tranquil presence. And so the great mystic Shahabuddin Yahya Sohrawardi uses this word Sakina to speak about a certain mystical experience. This mystical experience is between two other experiences. The first stage is that of flashing lights, sudden rapturous ecstasies which dissipate as quickly as they have appeared. Those are the lawaya. But there's a second, a further stage where light subsists, clarity indwells and remains steadily. And he calls this experience Sakina, the tranquil abiding of light in the heart. And beyond that, of course, there's still a further stage which he calls the effacing light. But this intermediary experience, he calls it the light of Sakina. And he quotes the verse of the Quran, Bidhikrullahi tatma'inul qulub. Through the remembrance of God, hearts know tranquility. The heart becomes serene. So we can see that according to the Kabbalists and according to the Sufis, based on their deep study of the Bible and of the Quran, the spirit that animates prophecy is a feminine spirit. But that leads us on now to a further question. If the function of prophecy is feminine, who are the women prophets? What is the role of actual historical women in the transmission of the divine truth? And here again, if we study the exoteric history of the religions, we find much dispiriting disheartening information. We find evidence of something of a conspiracy to cover over the contributions of illuminated women. However, beneath the accumulated occlusion, we can find traces of the significance of women's roles in the transmission of the divine truth. So if we turn to the Indic civilization, of course, there are several great cycles of revelation that revealed the prophetic spirit in the Indian subcontinent. And yet, in India, as elsewhere, very often it is the male mythological figures that predominate. We hear the most about Rama, Krishna, Shiva, and Buddha. And we would like to know more about Sita, Radha, Parvati, and Tara, among others. But when we do investigate, we find that each of these feminine figures is no mere accidental counterpart, but is significant, each in her own right. In the case of Sita, we know that her personality precedes that, historically precedes that of Rama. She is mentioned in the Vedas, where Rama is not. She is of an earlier significance. Her name means furrow. She is a chthonic feminine figure associated with the earth. She is, it is said in the Ramayana, born from the earth. Now, in much of the Ramayana, she seems to be merely the passive victim of circumstances, while the champion of the narrative appears to be Rama. However, in the end, she has her ultimate victory. She claims her authority, and she makes the decision to return to the earth. Now, turning to the myths of Vrindavan, the pastoral romance of Krishna and the gopis, we find that Radha is of great significance, particularly through the eyes of the bhakti mystics, and that some bhaktis have gone so far as to say that Radha is much more central, because if Krishna is the beloved, Radha is the lover, and the lover, after all, is the locus in which love manifests. All of the experience happens in her heart. And if one studies the literature of the bhakti tradition, for example, the Gita Govinda, she is the leading voice. Her experience defines the myth. And then in the case of Parvati, here too, if one studies the lore superficially, she seems secondary. In the Shiva Shastras, Shiva's teachings are presented in the form of dialogues in which Parvati appears as the chela, the disciple, and she is taught, instructed by Shiva. But if we look deeper, we see that she is not merely passively receiving teachings. She is asking questions, and her questions are cues, and those cues basically elicit the wisdom that Shiva has to offer. And if it were not for her role in this regard, Shiva would offer nothing. Moreover, Shiva is something of an antisocial wild man with very destructive tendencies. But through Parvati, he is largely domesticated, and his destructive power is put to very positive ends. Now, turning to the case of Buddhism, I can tell you that from my own experience, about 22 years ago, I was living in the foothills of the Himalayas and studying Buddhism under the auspices of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I used to attend daily Dharma lectures and occasionally meet with His Holiness. And in the course of those studies, I believe it was in the course of studying a commentary on Shantideva's Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, I encountered the statement that women cannot attain enlightenment, enlightenment cannot be attained in a woman's body. A woman can accumulate meritorious karma, but she will have to be reborn as a man in order to attain ultimate enlightenment. So when I heard that, it struck me as a little odd. And the next time that I had the privilege of an interview with His Holiness, I raised that question. And I said, is it true that women, enlightenment is impossible in a woman's body? And he said, it was true. It was true before Tara. And he said, Tara is the world's first feminist. And then he burst out laughing. It was an unforgettable moment, a joyous moment, because he didn't contradict the tradition. He said it was true, but somehow he made an accommodation for a much larger perspective. And it went straight into my heart. His words went into my heart. So Tara is emblematic of the power of the feminine within the Buddhist tradition. We may also look to the aunt of Gautama Buddha, Mahaprajapati Gotami, who was the sister of the mother of the Buddha and who was the foster mother of the Buddha who raised him and later was requested ordination and was refused again and again, but persisted in insisting that she receive that privilege. And she and a band of women continued to ask for that right until finally the Buddha conceded it under some very limiting circumstances, under some very limiting terms. So she was very tenacious in ensuring that that women have a full part to play in this, what she saw as this crucial dispensation of women. She did not want to reject it because she was rejected, and yet she had to find a modus vivendi, a way for women to participate fully. Now, in the Beni Israeli tradition, the Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition, there are many feminine exemplars. The first, of course, is Eve. And the case of Eve is another case of a woman getting a very bad name. Of course, Eve is identified as the agent of humanity's downfall into sin, the original temptress. And moreover, the creation of Eve has conventionally been imagined as a kind of an afterthought, that Eve was created from a rib of Adam as something secondary. So those perspectives, of course, continue to reverberate in the collective culture and have very serious implications for women. However, mystics have continuously challenged those assumptions without feeling the need to overturn the essential myth itself, the myth of Eve's creation. An example of this is the 16th century occultist Cornelius Agrippa, who wrote a treatise on the dignity of women. And he said that Adam's name comes from Adama, which means soil, the soil of the earth, whereas Eve's name, Hawa, comes from life. So that suggests some great eminence. And he also says that although conventionally it is said that since Eve was created from a rib of Adam, she's something secondary, he says no, Adam was created from inanimate substance, but Eve was a further creation from the animate substance of the first human being, a further perfection. And moreover, he says that creation was sequential, and that in the full course of creation, it is extremely significant that Eve is the final creation, the ultimate creation, after which God rested. So he writes, "For when the Creator came to the creation of woman, he rested himself in this creation, thinking that he had nothing more honorable to create. In her were completed and consummated all the wisdom and power of the Creator. After her, no creation could be found or imagined. Since, therefore, woman is the ultimate end of creation, the most perfect accomplishment of all the works of God, and the perfection of the universe itself, who will deny that she possesses honor surpassing every other creature?" And now, as to the question of Eve's role as an agent of humanity's fall, of course, the Sufi mystics have a special insight into the fall and consider it as providential. Halaj and Ain al-Quzat Hamadani have explained how Iblis operated under divine direction to guide humanity into this condition of estrangement, which is also a condition of that of a pioneer into new realms of possibility. And so Hazrat Nayat Khan says, Hazrat Nayat Khan reflects on both of these aspects of Eve, actually. Reflecting on her coming after the creation of Adam, he says, "In man we have designed our image, in woman we have finished it." And with respect to the question of the fall, he says in the Gayan, "Hail to my exile from the Garden of Eden to the earth. If I had not fallen, I should not have had the opportunity of probing the depths of life." Of course, the Hebrew Bible invokes many women prophets, and the Talmud identifies seven women prophets as primary: Sarah, Miriam, Deborah, Hannah, Abigail, Huldah, and Esther. And according to one tradition, there are 60,000 male prophets and 60,000 female prophets. It is said that Sarah, in the rabbinical literature, in the Israeliyat, it is said that Sarah was a greater prophet than Abraham, had greater prophetic insight. And of course, both Sarah and Hagar are figures of tremendous inspiration and significance, and they are the foremothers of two great civilizations, the Hebrews and the Arabs. The Arabs are the descendants of Hajar, who was exiled from the family of Abraham into the desert and left in the desert carrying her small child, Ismail. And she was, by the divine guidance, she was shown water, and that water became the well that is now known as Zemzem. And in her desperate searching for that water, she circumscribed an area of land that has become sacred land, that is the place where Mecca now exists, and where later Abraham came and with Ismail constructed the Kaaba. So that was a place that was, let's say, sanctified through Hajra's exile. Now the rivalry between Sarah and Hagar continues to reverberate down the generations as a source of tension, which continues to have serious consequences in the flashpoint of Jerusalem and Palestine. And there is a need within this prophetic, vision of planetary prophetology to heal these ancient wounds and bring unity once again. Reb Zalman tells me that, according to some rabbinical commentators, the woman that Abraham married after the death of Sarah, named Keturah, is Hagar under another name, and so that Abraham and Hagar were reconciled in the end. But the Muslims, as they expanded out from Mecca, were first known, interestingly enough, as Magarite or Magre or Muhajirun, which are all names that contain two references. One is the reference to Hajar, to Hagar, as their ancient matriarch. And the other reference is to the experience of exile, which is the exile of Hagar, but also the exile of the early Muslim communities who were had to seek refuge outside of Mecca. So they were known as the descendants of Hagar, the branch of prophecy that flows through this line. Now, in the Christian sphere, the figure of Jesus is so powerful that the relationship between Father and Son is primary. And yet there has been felt a deep need for the balancing of the masculinity of that relationship of Father and Son by means of the presence of the mother. And the mother, of course, is Mary, the mother of Jesus. And she is significant particularly for her attribute of the Immaculate Conception. And the story of the Immaculate Conception, as told in the Gospel of Luke, tells of how the angel descended to present to her the good tidings of the prospect of the advent of Jesus through her womb. But she is not merely the object of this act, but she is a willing and conscious participant. She is invited, so to speak, and she answers that invitation with a fiat of consent. This is her fiat, her decision, her judgment, in which she gives her consent wholeheartedly and says, let it be. And that act where she consciously, wholeheartedly opens herself to this role represents a synergy. That is the metaphysical term for this act of hers, a synergy between human will and divine will, a perfect instance of the harmonization of the free will of the human being acting in consort with the wisdom of the divine plan. So she symbolizes synergy. She also symbolizes the paradoxical conjunction of fertility and purity. She is virginal, but she's also creative and fertile. She's a virgin and a mother. And therefore, she reminds all of us, whether male or female, that to be human does not mean no longer to be angelic, and to be angelic means not to be no longer human. That we live on multiple dimensions of reality, and her Immaculate Conception represents the wholeness of an identity that includes these multiple dimensions. So she is the perfect expression of the coinciding of innocence and experience. Of course, when her virginity has been fixated upon as a purely literal physical phenomenon, then her example can give to women the impression of an unattainable ideal. The idea of being fertile and virginal is one that Mary performs as, so to speak, alone of her sex. And if this understanding becomes too literal, then women feel constantly degraded by comparison and sullied and impure by comparison with this pure archetype of perfection. But we need not understand Mary's perfection in those terms. We can understand this in the mystical sense in which I have described and fully recognize Mary's physical womanhood and experience as a woman. And women in the Christian tradition, women mystics, have articulated a spiritual vision that is distinct from the spiritual vision that male medieval mystics described. The writings of women mystics in the Middle Ages reveal an ability to express personal experiences, whereas the male mystical writings often tend to represent doctrinal abstractions. The writings of medieval Christian women mystics speak about what happened to me, what I felt, a bodily, physical experience. Now we come to the case of Islam. And here we confront a question. Does Islam recognize women prophets? That is a question. Now, on one side of the question, we have this evidence that in Surah Yusuf, it is said, we did not send before you as prophets any illa rijalan, except men. So that is a verse of the Quran. But how do we understand this verse? First of all, we know that in English, the word man or mankind has often been used generically to refer to humanity. So when we read particularly documents from prior eras, whenever we read the word man or mankind, we have to understand by that humanity as a whole. And so we can certainly understand, it is quite justifiable to interpret this verse in the sense that we have not sent prophets who are simply supernatural beings, extraterrestrials. We have sent to you human beings, humans like you, people of your own land. So that is a very legitimate way to understand this verse. Now, as additional evidence, we can turn to Surat al-Anbiya, the surah of the prophets. And in this surah, there is a invocation of a series of prophets, just as the name of the surah is the surah of the prophets. As you might expect, a number of prophets are invoked in the surah. And these prophets are Abraham, Noah, David, Solomon, Job, Ishmael, Idris, Dhul-Kifl, Jonah, Zechariah, John, and finally, a figure is mentioned who is feminine, who is a woman, Mary. So this also needs to be seriously weighed as evidence that in a long list of prophets, at the end comes the person of Mary in a surah whose title is the prophets. So there is certainly no conclusive scriptural evidence in Islam that women cannot be acknowledged as holders of the prophetic function. And there seems to be evidence that, on the contrary, it is not only a possibility, but an actuality. So now I want to come to a conclusion. In conclusion, we can say that although recorded history shows a prevalent pattern wherein women have been frequently, consistently marginalized, denied positions of power. Nonetheless, in all of the major prophetic traditions, including those that were revealed within this historical phase of misogyny, the divine feminine continues to be affirmed, and that specifically it has been the role of the mystics to retrieve and reaffirm the significance of the feminine in conceiving the divine. We can also say that the mystics have recognized that prophecy itself is mediated by a feminine emanation, the Sakinah. And moreover, that the mystics of multiple religions have recognized innumerable women as qualified with the attribute of prophethood. So the task for our time in envisioning the planetary prophetology of today is to consolidate this acknowledgement and retrieve as much as possible the vestiges of the voices of the women masters, saints, and prophetic figures. And thereby redress the imbalance that continues to persist to this day. Finally, it should also be said that the spiritual traditions of the world have frequently reflected the protocols and tendencies of the mainstream society. It has not been possible even for the mystics to operate in a vacuum, and that mystical organizations and traditions have made concessions. And the consequence has been a much larger scale of male participation in sacred practice versus female. Now, this is changing in our time. Of course, females have great personalities, of course, have challenged these norms and sometimes have suffered very serious consequences. But nonetheless, these norms have generally prevailed. But now there is the opportunity for change. Changes are afoot, as Murshid clearly saw, and women are participating in new ways. And women are undertaking disciplines of sacred practice that have been traditionally the exclusive purview of men. And so new questions are arising, because since men have been the transmitters of these forms, to what extent have those forms become customized to the particular disposition, biologically and culturally, of men? And to what extent are women now entering a man's sphere and needing, therefore, to express their own authentic articulations of that experience, and even in some case adapt the forms to reflect that experience? So the role of women in spirituality today is a pioneering role, as I suppose it is in many spheres of life. And within that pioneering role, there is great wisdom to draw upon from the past, many precedents, many examples of true feminine inspiration. But there is also a need to live with the questions of the present and look hopefully toward the future. So I hope that what I have shared today can be received as a modest contribution to that enormous and extremely important undertaking, and that this undertaking will require a serious conversation, an existential conversation, and that conversation has to include women at its very heart. And I see the signs of that emerging conversation, and that is where I place my trust. And if I have any word of suggestion to offer, it is that we all unite in bringing this conversation forward with humility, with clarity, with love, so that we can be part of the midwifery of the new planetary civilization that is waiting to be born. Thank you for your attention.